I am Joe Torti. I'm superintendent of insurance for the state of Rhode Island, and I am the moderator for this panel. So I'd just like to thank the panelists in session two. That was a really great panel. They gave a good perspective and really set the foundation for what we're going to be talking about in panel three. Our final discussion here, which we'll talk about market, transparency, regulatory challenges, and solutions related to insurers' use of captives. And I'll introduce our panel now, but I'm actually going to do just a brief 15-minute presentation to start us off at the beginning before we get into questions for panelists. But I will introduce everyone at this point. And our first panelist is Nick Gerhart, and Nick is in the middle. He's insurance commissioner for the state of Iowa. Commissioner Gerhart serves on the NAIC Executive Committee, the Life and Annuity Committee, the Financial Condition Committee, the International Committee, and is chair of the Variable Annuities Issues Working Group, which we'll hear a lot about during this discussion. In addition, Commissioner Gerhart is a board member of the National Insurance Producer Registry. He was named by the U.S. Treasury in 2014 to serve on the Federal Advisory Committee on Insurance that advises the Federal Insurance Office on domestic and international policy. He's also represented the NAIC at the International Association of Insurance Supervisors and at the EU-US Dialogue Project. Next to Nick on the far end is Paul Graham, who is Senior Vice President, Insurance Regulation, and Chief Actuary for the American Council of Life Insurers in Washington, D.C. Currently, Mr. Graham is spending a majority of his time as the ACLI Project Manager for the Principles-Based Reserves and Captive Projects. He's also responsible for policy issues related to annuities, disability insurance, and long-term care insurance. And thank you for joining us, Paul. And closest to me, just to my left, is John Finston, who is our final panelist. And Mr. Finston is General Counsel and Deputy Commissioner for the California Department of Insurance. He's practiced regulatory law for 35 years and currently serves on the Conservation and Liquidation Office Governance Committee and as a board member of the Federal Crop Insurance Corporation. During his tenure at the California Department of Insurance, Mr. Finston has served as chair of the Receivership and Insolvency Task Force, vice chair of the Reinsurance Task Force, chair of the Qualified Jurisdictions Working Group, and co-chair of the Guarantee Fund Working Group. So thank you all for participating. I've been on several panels, but I've never actually moderated a panel, so I'm told I can just cut anyone off if I don't like what they're saying, so. That's true. That's my usual way of operating. I'll just touch on captives. This may be my last captive presentation. God, I just realized that. And I found out today I have a guy named Fred Rice to thank for all of my work on captives. I Googled him while I was sitting there, and I found he did die in 1993 because I was going to give him a call, but. you've already heard the history of captives earlier today, so I won't touch on that at all. But the key in this slide is that captive regulation in the U.S. developed outside the traditional NAIC solvency framework, and the reason it did is because it's self-insurance. It developed as self-insurance. Companies could decide to self-insure through a captive, or they could decide to self-insure without utilizing a captive. So there was no need to put the NAIC solvency framework around captives. So it did develop a little differently than traditional insurance regulation did. Because of that, it's also excluded from the NAIC accreditation program. The accreditation program looks at multi-state insurers. It looks at the impact of our solvency standards on traditional companies, and it made no sense if we didn't have the NAIC solvency framework around captives to include them in the accreditation program. Well, things have changed a little bit recently, so we'll talk a little bit about those changes as we go on. I'll jump right in. The fact that these things developed outside of the NAIC solvency framework leads us to some inconsistencies or disparate regulation when we look at some of these transactions that we've we've looked at recently, and the XXX, AXXX variable annuities, and so forth. The inconsistencies from one state to another, and they don't really matter when you're looking at a self-insurance vehicle, but when we're looking at a captive that's reinsuring XXX or AXXX business or doing variable annuities, we need to be very careful that there's the same transparency that we have with traditional companies, and we don't have that with captives. We have financial statements that are confidential in many instances. We have different bases of accounting depending on the state you're in. Again, we have some that file with the NAIC. We have some that don't file with the NAIC. We even have some state captive laws that don't allow financial statements of captives to be shared with other state regulators. So a lot of variance between the states on regulation of captives. There have been complaints that it's more difficult to assess the industry position because of this. You've heard the concerns of the federal government, the FSOC, the FIO, the OFR, the Federal Reserve have all stated their concerns with captives. Numerous press articles on captives. So this is something that, you know, we've been very concerned with and we've been working on for quite a while. When we talk about captives, you know, the first thing I think of is, you know, we have baseline accounting requirements out there that apply to traditional companies. We have conservative accounting rules that provide consistency regardless of the state of domicile. That's the whole point of our uniform solvency framework. We do have permitted practices that differ among the states, but they're intended to be few in number, and they are few in number, and they include public disclosure and even disclosure to regulators prior to being implemented. So we've put some rules around that so that we keep our uniform accounting requirements. So captive transactions sort of work outside of that framework. So, you know, that's the big concern that we had when we first started looking at these. So when a significant portion of the industry is utilizing captives as a reserve financing vehicle, we've got to, you know, determine that it's being done consistently. And as other panelists mentioned previously, that, you know, everything is uniform, and that, as Neil, I think, specifically said, we don't have one state doing one thing, one company doing one thing, and the state right next door, there's completely different way of creating the captive. So what are we talking about when we talk about XXX, AXXX? I don't think anyone really got into what we're specifically looking at. And all it is, it just refers to NAIC model number 830. XXX is Roman 30. Somebody picked up the 30 on model 830 and decided to call it XXX. AXXX is basically referring to actuarial guideline 38. It's just application of the model 830 to universal life with secondary guarantee policy. So that's all we're talking about when we say XXX and AXXX business. So what caused the problem to begin with? What's the industry's issue with Reg XXX and AXXX? The problem that the industry has is they price policies using expected assumptions, and the premiums collected as a result of that aren't sufficient to fund the statutory reserves that are out there. So a company's faced with a situation where the statutory reserves may be one, two, or three times what the actual economic reserves are, and they've priced their policies in accordance with what their expected losses will be, so that they just don't have enough premium to fund the difference. And so they have to look for other sources of capital, and that's where captive transactions would come in. XXX, AXXX was sort of a reaction to the industry taking some liberties with reserves for term and universal life policies in the late 90s. We looked at the problem, we addressed the issue by adopting XXX and AXXX around 2000, 2001 in most states. And I think we went a little overboard in the conservatism that's built into XXX and AXXX. It really uses a risk-free interest rate, requires the use of a risk-free risk-free interest rate, so it's not realistic with respect to the returns that the company's going to have. Also requires, doesn't allow for preferred risks, so that a smoker may get the same risk charge as a non-smoker or other preferred risk. So it's going to make a big difference in what the reserve requirements are. So again, this was the industry's reaction, and it was a logical reaction to what happened. So Neil talked a lot about the reinsurance framework. I won't repeat what was said in the prior session, but I'll just touch on the main requirements. And again, I just want to give credit to Rector and Associates for doing a fantastic job on this. When we first started looking at this, I was a proponent of let's just fix the reserve. Why are we going crazy doing this? And Neil came up with a way to collateralize or require primary security and other security, look at a logical way of determining the reserve based on primarily PBR, and come up with a framework that was easy to implement from the ceding insurer side. So the whole idea is to book the full statutory reserve. We're not changing what the reserve requirement is. We really can't change what the reserve requirement is until PBR is implemented. We're going to collateralize that reserve requirement with the tiered reserve, as you heard about earlier. Primary securities for the actuarial method reserve, which is basically the PBR, the expected PBR reserve once PBR is implemented. We're going to disclose the assets supporting the reserves, and there's going to be an appropriate capital charge if you don't appropriately support the reserves with primary assets. This is a slide that you'll see in many presentations. It's NAIC had created this a while ago. It's just a good depiction of the way the reinsurance framework operates. The statutory reserve is the entire cylinder. The light blue part on the top is the statutory reserve minus the PBR level reserves, the reserves in accordance with the actuarial method that's included in AG 48. It shows that primary security needs to support that actuarial method reserve, the PBR level reserve. Generally, that's cash, some SBO listed securities, and if you're doing coinsurance or modified coinsurance, you can use some policy loans, certain derivatives, commercial loans that are rated highly. So the amount above that, the light blue, is acceptable security. It's whatever the commissioner of the state of domicile of the ceding company decides is acceptable security. So how did we really implement this framework? Ultimately, how we're going to implement the framework is through modifications to the credit for reinsurance model law. And we've actually got some proposed modifications to the credit for reinsurance model law that'll be discussed at this meeting at the Reinsurance Task Force. But the model law is a relatively simple change, but there's still some controversy on where we may end up there. There is option one, option two, and option three of the model law, and it just determines what type of authority regulators may have in creating a regulation to address captive transactions. Option one, I believe, limits our authority to XXX, AXXX. Option two, expands it to variable annuity captives and long-term care captives. Option three sort of throws out some very broad language where we can address anything that we feel necessary to address, so that we don't have to go back and change the model law every time something new pops up. But there is a lot of controversy on that, and there are a lot of issues with putting that broad authority in there. So I'm sure there'll be a lot more discussion on that at the Reinsurance Task Force. We would like to, however, get a model law adopted by the end of the year, if at all possible. We know that we can't get the model regulation done. We are going to continue to work on the model regulation into 2016. So you'll see, you'll see a new model regulation that deals with XXX and AXXX reinsurance transactions. We have some draft language out there, but certainly that's going to change as we look closer at the issues in 2016. But again, that should move pretty quickly, and we should have something final in place very soon. Again, that was the long-term solution, because it takes states a while to get a model law passed and a while to get a model regulation passed. So in the interim, we have Actuarial Guideline 48, and that was created so that we could have something to implement quickly. We implement it really through the actuarial opinion and memorandum regulation, and we're allowed to, set a standard for these transactions through Actuarial Guideline 48. So the key to Actuarial Guideline 48 is once a state gets the model law, the new credit for reinsurance model law changes in place and implements a model regulation that addresses these things, there's no longer a need for that interim regulation. And so there's a sunset provision in AG 48, and it will go away as soon as that model law is implemented. I like to throw in at the bottom of the slide all the time, the permanent solution is PBR, although there's going to be these captives will exist for a long time as this business runs off. This doesn't apply. Nothing applies retroactively. PBR does not apply retroactively, I should say. So the captives will not go away, although I think one state put a provision in that may allow PBR to apply retroactively in certain circumstances, but we're not sure how that's going to work at this point in time. But again, the light at the end of the tunnel, the permanent solution that we've worked out is PBR, and we're well on our way. I think we have 39 states, and we need 42 to get it fully implemented. So we're pretty darn close, and we're almost at 70% of the premium, and we need to get to 75% of the premium. Just touch on AG 48 very quickly, since there's been already been a lot of discussion on AG 48. But the idea behind AG 48 was to establish a uniform national standard governing XXX and AXXX reserve financing. The actuarial guideline defines the actuarial method, which is basically a PBR method. It defines primary security, at least it tried to define primary security, and then as one of the speakers alluded to in the last panel, we're getting some questions on whether or not there can be some creative assets utilized as primary securities, and one of the things is a K note that I've heard about. There are other inquiries out there, so we're looking very closely at what constitutes primary security. We thought we had a very clear and easy definition in AG 48, and once again, some very smart people are getting very creative in what might constitute a primary security. So stay tuned on that level. The other thing is the effective date was January 1st of 2015, so there may be a rush to create some of these toward the end of the year. We're getting toward the end of the year. I know the transactions slowed down at the beginning of the year, but I think we're going to get a few of these transactions done before the end of the year. I'm sure companies will be looking for it. Again, the guideline sunsets as soon as a state passes the NAIC model law and model regulation. So what have we done with respect to enhancing transparency and analysis techniques? There was a lot of discussion when we first started looking at this that there was no transparency. Each state did things differently. Most captive transactions or most captive financial statements were not public documents, so we needed to take a look at transparency and fix the problem. So we got in last year a 2014 blanks change that added a pretty good disclosure schedule on these transactions, and we modified it this year to include the new transactions that are done subsequent to AG 48, so that there's sort of two parts to it. There's actually four parts to the schedule, but the schedule is split between pre-AG 48 and post-AG 48 transactions. There's lots of information out there. Part one has all the XXX and AXXX sessions. Part two has transactions subject to disclosure. Part three has collateral for all the XXX and AXXX transactions. And part four has non-collateral assets supporting reserves for all of the affiliate XXX and AXXX transactions. So we've got a lot more transparency already. For 2014 we had it, and we will have even more in the 2015 financial statements that you'll see. One other thing that I want to note, actually I should go back to the slide at the bottom, Part B accreditation requirements related to the above. We actually did some financial analysis handbook changes that require a review of new proposed XXX, AXXX transactions. We have requirements for analyzing an existing XXX or AXXX transaction. We put holding company analysis requirements. So we built a framework around these things. And to enforce that framework, we put in a Part B accreditation requirement related to the holding company analysis, related to the financial analysis handbook requirements. So under our appropriate depth of review requirement, under our accreditation program, we will be evaluating the states in their review of these transactions. I'll just quickly jump to variable annuities. I know we had a little bit of discussion earlier on variable annuities. When we did our original survey on how companies were using captives, the number one use was for XXX, AXXX, so that was the first thing we tackled. Number two was variable annuities. So, you know, at the beginning of this year, we decided that we're going to, you know, tackle the variable annuities captives, try to figure out what the solution to the variable annuities captives are, and come up with that solution. I always said with XXX, AXXX, it was easy. The PBR was the ultimate solution. So, you know, we knew we were just looking at captives in the interim. We were looking at an interim solution to work things out and make things uniform while we were working on PBR. Well, with variable annuities, we don't know what that ultimate solution is, or we didn't know what that ultimate solution was. So what we did was we created the Variable Annuities Issues Working Group, and Commissioner Gerhardt is in charge of that group. He's done a wonderful job with the group. I don't know if he volunteered for it or was voluntold, or he got stuck with it, I guess. Yeah, so he's got the, you know, it's a huge challenge to tackle this, but we've got a good consultant. Oliver Wyman has done a great job so far of gathering information from the companies, looking at why companies use variable annuities captives, and it's not a reserving issue. It's not the same as the XXX, AXXX issues. There are many reasons why companies form these captives, and they came out with they had their preliminary findings and conclusions. They presented it to the Variable Annuities Issues Working Group on September 10th, so it's relatively new, and they've suggested that there could be a solution that would actually work to even retroactively eliminate the variable annuity captives that are out there. Again, it is going to be a challenge, but I think Nick is up to that challenge and he's going to get it done. So I really, really am encouraged by the work that's been done so far. Right now, we're looking at a quantitative impact study. It's already approved and funded. We're sharing the cost of this quantitative impact study with the industry. NAIC is basically doing half of the cost, and the industry doing the other half. Actually, NAIC is doing a little more than half. But so we want to get the quantitative impact study done during 2016, and I think it will go a long way to proving that we can come up with a solution to this and that we can address the issues that the industry is having and why they're forming these variable annuity captives. And we have questions on that, so I'm not going to get into the details that were in the Oliver Wyman report. Long-term care, that's another thing that you may have heard. You may have seen it in the press and some of the federal agencies' reports that were out there. There are only two groups that are utilizing long-term care captives. We've, you know, done some research on them. There are not reserving issues with these particular companies that are utilizing them. There's some uniqueness to why they're using a long-term care captive. So this is something that's going to be tackled by the E-Committee, is, you know, concurrent with what we're doing with variable annuities captives. But again, this is a relatively small issue. There's only two groups utilizing them, so not a big issue. I think Professor Hoyt mentioned long-term care captives. That's a different type of captive he was talking about. He was talking about nursing homes that may form a self-insurance type entity to help them with control the cost of the liability insurance that they might have. Long-term care captive we're talking about here is to actually finance long-term care reserves. But again, very small issue at this point in time. There's some uniqueness to why they're being used, and we're going to look at it closely. I'll just touch on some of the accreditation issues that are out there. The way that we enforce our baseline accounting requirements is through the accreditation program. We have a uniform system of state-based regulation, and what we care about in the accreditation program is multi-state insurers. And what's happened is, as I mentioned at the beginning, captives are not included in accreditation for obvious reasons. If they're self-insurance vehicles, there's no need to include them in the accreditation program. Well, captives have evolved into something more than just self-insurance vehicles. So now we had to go back and look at the accreditation preamble, which defines multi-state insurer, and try to determine whether or not we should have included, or we should be including, XXX, AXXX captives as entities that are subject to the accreditation requirements, variable annuities captives as subject to the accreditation requirements, and long-term care captives as subject to the accreditation requirements. So Director Huff, as chair of the F committee, is going to tackle that problem, I'm sure, next year. So again, it's a significant issue for purposes of accreditation. We have to include all multi-state insurers in order to ensure that we maintain our uniform system of state-based regulation. So just to quickly wrap up, the NAIC membership and officers have considered captives a priority since 2011, 2012. We're going to continue to consider it a priority. We've made significant progress. We've tackled the XXX, AXXX problem. We're just about done in that area. We're well along to a solution on the variable annuities issues, or at least starting to come up with a solution on the variable annuities issues working group and those type of captives. We've also got a new committee, e-committee process that we've implemented to try to identify issues that are related to national solvency issues, national solvency framework issues. We're not trying to take away the state's authority to deal with single state issues and to deal with issues that apply, you know, specifically to something going on in their state. We're looking at things like XXX and AXXX that are clearly national issues that should not be addressed with a single state solution. So we're trying to implement something through the Financial Condition Committee where if something comes up like this, if someone knows, if an industry person knows, if a regulator knows, they'll be aware to come to the NAIC, and through the NAIC process we can come up with a national solution for the problem rather than coming up with single state solutions and then backtracking and try to make each of the single state solutions uniform. So that's the whole point of what we're looking at in the e-committee. So going forward, we shouldn't be seeing a lot of these single state solutions anymore. And that is all I have at this point in time, and I guess we'll reserve questions and comments for the end and jump right into our panel discussion at this point in time.